Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tom Britt. I want to welcome you and thank you for coming to the second installment of the Jeffrey Lanning Coe Lecture Series. I was looking around to see, I brought my seven-year-old son with me today, but I don't see him in the audience. He and the babysitter are out roaming around, and I wanted to tell on him. I had mentioned last time about his interest in things archaeological and anthropological, and I was telling Billy Oliver a little while ago about how my son, Elijah, had been up under the house digging out our basement, and every rock that he found, every piece of trash that he found that the builders had left behind, he was saving up and ended up, make a long story short, with a blanket out by the side of the road with all of these rocks and pieces of glass and a sign saying, "For sale." And I had to assure him that those were not as valuable to other people as they were to him. Maybe if they stayed down there another 1,000 years, they might be. But, and Billy, of course, being the archaeologist that he is, was saying, well, what you needed to do was explain to him how this glass was made and how it differs from bottle glass. Okay, what? Well, yeah, all right. We'll get to that. But, but I was hoping he would be in here so that he would hear me tell on him with that, but I guess it's just as well he's not. Well, I want to tell you, the Coe Foundation is happy to be involved in Archaeology Days, and I'm sure y'all have seen everything going on out there. It's just a beautiful sight to see so many people out there getting involved in it. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to some special individuals who are here. Mrs. Sally Denton Coe and some of her family are here. Good afternoon to you, including her grandson, Jeffrey Coe III. Glad that you could make that. Mrs. Melinda Stewart, Ms. Elizabeth Buford, there you are, Director of the North Carolina Museum of History. Dr. David Brook, Director of Archives and History, is here. And good friends of Dr. and Mrs. Stewart, the Brockingtons. Did they make it? There you are, hi. I'd like to thank the Jeffrey Lanning Coe Lecture Series sponsors, the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, the North Carolina Museum of History, Archives and History, State Historic Sites and Properties, as well as the North Carolina Humanities Council. It's wonderful to have such great supporters and friends helping to spread the importance of archaeological knowledge. You're in for a special treat this afternoon. Dr. George Stewart, the founder and president of the Center for Maya Research and former vice president for research exploration for the National Geographic Society, is here to talk to us about discovering the Maya. Dr. Stewart is a world-renowned expert on Mesoamerica, Mayan, and North American archaeology, as well as hieroglyphic writing and art history. Dr. Stewart has his PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, where he was a student of Dr. Jeffrey Lanning Coe. Now, Dr. Stewart will not be able to take questions from the audience following his presentation, but because we're being told we have to get out, but he has said he will be glad to talk to anyone out at the CIFAR table. Any questions you might have, any comments, he will be glad to stay around for a while so that y'all can talk. Please join me in a warm round of applause for Dr. George Stewart.
Thank you. Can y'all hear me okay? Okay. I first came to this area in earnest about 35 years ago. I had a full-time job in Washington at the National Geographic Society, which I loved, and came down to see Jeffrey Coe. Jeffrey said, "Why don't you come down here and get your doctorate?" And I said, "That's easy for you to say because I've got a full-time job in Washington, 8 hours a day and a salary and benefits, marriage, 2 children, you know." He said, "Try it anyway." So I did. I wrote a series of memorandums and then somehow got to come to Chapel Hill for a year and study. I was a little arrogant at the time because I thought I knew it all. I had had 50 months, a little over 4 years solid in the field in working in archaeology in both the southeastern U.S. and Yucatan, various parts of Mexico and Central America. But in that 1 year, I learned more, I think, from Jeffrey and from his colleague, Donald Brockington, than I had ever thought I would be able to learn or needed to learn. But I got an incredible education in a very short period of time. due mainly to the talents and knowledge of those two people. And I'd like to thank them. Today I want to talk about the Maya. People are always saying, whatever happened to the Maya? And I always say, well, nothing. There's 7 million of them now speaking a lot of different Maya languages, and they're doing fine. But what I want to talk about today is a little bit about the Maya as they were between, around 400 and 800 AD, and how we found out what we know through a few key discoveries. Discoveries are funny things. We talk about the discovery of America, and I just heard a talk outside about how the Native Americans discovered the Europeans. And this was very interesting and made me think a little bit, as it should have. But I want to talk about some discoveries over the past 60 years or so. Because if we don't talk about those older discoveries, we won't know what the new discoveries mean. So I'll go into the history a little bit. The main thing that happened, and I want to begin this with, is one day in the 1560s or thereabouts, a bunch of Maya in full ceremonial regalia walked into the Catholic Church in Santo Tomas Chichicastenango, Guatemala, and said, we've got a story to tell you. You've been sitting here telling us all about your thing. We got a neat story to tell you about our thing. They didn't use these exact words, but this is sort of a paraphrase. They may have had a hieroglyphic book with them, we don't know. But they sat down and told the K'iche Maya story of creation and the story of how the world started. They told a wonderful story of the topography of the universe. They said in the middle there's a big tree, the Yashte, the Ceiba tree. And on the surface where people walk, it has its limits. It has four sides and four corners. And each of those sides and each of those corners is associated with a certain color. The north is yellow, the south is white, the west is black, the east is red. The middle is blue-green, Yash, the name of the tree, the Yashte. The blue-green tree, the precious tree, the new tree of life. The foliage of the Ceiba tree reached into the heavens, into the 13 layers of the sky, each quarter of which had its own supernatural figures. The roots reached into Xibalbah, the underworld, which had its own set of supernatural figures, most of them pretty horrible. And our only knowledge, really, firsthand, of the topography of Xibalbah came from this story. The manuscript that Father Jimenez copied down, and he knew K'iche Maya, and he knew Spanish, and he wrote both down in parallel columns in the Latin alphabet. The manuscript is called the Popol Vuh, and it's now in the Newberry Library in Chicago for some complicated reason. And it tells the story of the Hero Twins, which is really interesting. The Hero Twins, okay, there were two brothers. Two brothers that were playing ball in a ball court. The old Mesoamericans had a ritual ball game that they played. And they made so much noise that it angered the gods of the underworld. And the gods said, come down and play a game with us. And they did. They climbed down the four sort of mossy steps into the underworld. 9 was the number associated with the underworld. 9 is the number, like the old Beatles song. And they crossed the river of abomination, and they found the road. They went down the west, the black road, to the center and met the gods of the underworld. The gods of the underworld challenged them to a ball game, and they played. And the two brothers lost, and they were decapitated. The head of one was hung in a calabash tree, and it turned into a skull, naturally. But one of the daughters of one of the underworld gods, Lady Shkik, walked up to the tree one day, looked at the head. She held out her hand, and the head spit in her hand, and she became pregnant. And she was expelled from the underworld and came up top to the world where people walk, and lived with an old weaver named Shmukane. And these Shmukane raised this girl until the birth of her twins. The two boys, Hunapu and Shpalamke, they grew up into magicians, blowgun artists. They were incredible hunters, pranksters. And they decided one day to avenge the death of their uncle and their father. So they played ball noisily in the ball court near the house. And the people down below said, "Come on down, Lord Death and all of his colleagues." And they went down the four steps, and they made a raft out of their blowguns, crossed the river, went down the road, pulled hairs out of their legs and sent them down the road. And these changed into mosquitoes, and those bit the lords of the underworld, and they yelled out their names and thus weakened themselves. And they put the hero twins through all of these tasks, through the house of the Kamatzots, the killer bats, the house of the obsidian knives, and the house of cold, and the house of darkness. And they came out of all these, and the hero twin said, "We'll show you a trick." And they cut each other apart and put each other back together again. Lords of the underworld said, "That was incredibly neat. Do it for us." They said, "Okay." And they cut the gods of the underworld apart and didn't put them back together again. They came walking out of the East Road and rose in the red east as the full moon and the sun. And they keep going around. And anybody who dies now makes the same journey. So with that in mind, let's start looking at the Maya and some of the discoveries now that we know a little bit about the invisible world. It's kind of an old map. You still see British Honduras on it, but we're talking archaeology here. It's a total area, this Maya area, which you see here. It's about half the size of Texas. It's about 600 miles from the Pacific coast here up to the Gulf coast here. And, you know, it's only 450 miles across North Carolina. North Carolina, Murphy and all that area would begin about here, and Wilmington would be about here if it were turned sideways and laid on this map. And indeed, if you travel from south to north on this map, the terrain is not unlike that of North Carolina. You begin here in the mountains, the highlands, the Maya highlands, with the towns of Zinakantan and Chamula and all these places that we hear about all the time. And you cross a kind of a Piedmont, the Alta Verapaz and all, and you get into the Petén region, and it flattens out and goes all the way to the coast. It's in the tropics, so it gets dry seasons and rainy seasons. And this is the land of the Maya. As I said before, there's about 6 million, 7 million of them now. Yucatec Maya up here, the Lacandon, the various highland groups in here. And it's just a hodgepodge, a patchwork quilt of different languages. And recent ongoing surveys show that between here and here are at least 5,800 archaeological sites. 40 of those have been excavated. And of those excavated, there have only been long-term programs at a couple of them. So, as you can imagine, we really don't know a lot about the Maya because we have a real sampling problem. But what we have is the knowledge of a civilization that flourished with city-states and kingdoms and royal courts, kings and queens and nobilities and family lineages, not unlike some of the things that were happening in Europe. They had a writing system, and we can read it now, and it talks about history and the exploits of kings, etc. The usual stuff. I can't think of a writing system that's not self-serving, and this one certainly is more than usual. These are the highlands. This is the town of Navinchauk in the Chiapas Highlands. But you can see the terrain, not unlike around Asheville. a street scene about 50 years ago in Antigua, showing the different textiles worn by the different towns at that time. Things are changing now with cell phones and transportation and all, but this shows you, it also shows you the continuation of the old archaeological pottery types, now in plastic and styrofoam, but the same forms and the same kinds of decoration. The Lowland Maya. Everybody depended on maize. This was it. And it was the basis of everything. And we'll talk more about that as we go on. This is a farmer up in northern Yucatan in the Puuc or Hill area, just south of Merida. And the tortilla cooked on the three hearthstones of the household. And the house type that has survived for probably 5,000 years and works. We've been through two hurricanes in houses like that, and they were fine. The rain inside the living room was horizontal, but the house stood up. This is a plate from the 6th century that shows the same sort of thing going on, the grinding of corn on a metate, with a guy sitting over in the corner smoking a cigarette, but dates from about, around 600. The head of the town of Santiago Atitlan, some years ago, but in effect, he's the same as the rulers of places like Copan, Honduras, where you can see here a statue of the king, Huachaclajun Cahuil, who was beheaded in 536 by a neighboring kingdom. And it embarrassed the city of Copan so much that they built a big hieroglyphic stairway extolling the virtues of their dynasty. This is Copan. And you can see the hieroglyphic stairway there, the big plaza, the cosmic little pyramid in the middle with the four staircases in the four cardinal directions. And there was probably a tree on top of that in, say, the 7th century. And all these buildings were probably painted red. There's the Copan River back there. But it's just one of the many sites. This was one of the first known of these so-called lost cities. The local Maya, of course, knew about all these lost cities from the very beginning. But it was lost cities, and great discoveries are very often defined as finds by white European males who happened to be on the scene and published. The Maya city of Palenque, of which this is about a 20th of the site that you see. It goes on for about 5 kilometers. And just last year, they found a building out in the bush that's bigger than this building, the palace, the famous palace of Palenque that was discovered in the 1780s. Tikal. We started realizing with Tikal and the way certain things are laid out there, Chris Jones up at the University of Pennsylvania and others, that most of the Maya sites are merely metaphorical landscapes replicating mountains and caves and lakes and bodies of water. So you get mountains, you get caves, the temple doorways, which lead you into the underworld, and there's inscriptions telling us that. The big plazas and things are metaphorical bodies of water. And a lot of the monuments are trees, because one of the words for stele, the upright monuments of the Maya, is tetun, or stone trees. And they still keep cropping up, these places. Just in the past 6 months, there have been about 3 major cities discovered in the Petén and other areas of Guatemala and Chiapas. This is up in the middle of the peninsula. This is about, a few years back, a couple of decades back, in fact. This is Chicaná when it was found. But you can see the temple is standing after 2,000 years or so. Here's the eyes of a great monster. There's the mouth, the doorway, so you can really walk into the underworld. But there are the teeth, and the porch down here is the lower jaw. You can see some of the teeth, and the nose is here. Anyway, and this was apparently where somebody lived, And this is where people went in to do other things, I suppose. We don't know the function of most Maya buildings, actually.